Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a close look, I mean really close, at the stuff everything's made of. We're talking crystallography. Forget just pretty rocks. For scientists, a crystal means order, a repeating pattern at the atomic level, our goal. Yeah. To kind of shortcut the learning curve on this, unpacking the rules behind material structure.
Exactly. And that order, that's the fundamental thing. You know, with something random like glass, you'd need coordinates for every single atom, a huge list. But a crystal? No, it's defined by its internal repetition. You just need a small repeating unit, what the sources call a handful of atoms, and that pattern tells you everything.
And this pattern has real consequences, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
It's why crystals are anisotropic. Their properties, like strength or how they conduct heat, they change depending on which direction you're looking at within the crystal.
Anisotropy. Okay, like wood grain. Strong one way, weaker another. Is that a fair comparison?
That's a great way to think about it, yeah. Or imagine a spring. Pushing it sideways is totally different from compressing it along its axis. Same idea, but with atoms.
Got it. Okay, let's lay down the cornerstone concept here. The sources keep coming back to this formula. Lattice plus motif. Crystal structure. Let's break that down. First, the lattice. This seems quite abstract. It's not the atoms themselves.
Not at all. Think of it as pure geometry, an infinite grid of imaginary points in space. The key rule is periodicity. If you stand on any point and look around, the view is identical to the view from any other point, just points in space.
Okay, an invisible scaffold. So where do the actual atoms come in?
That's the motif. The motif is the real stuff. The specific atom or group of atoms or even molecule that you place at each of those imaginary lattice points. And this is where the variety comes from. Take copper, for instance. It uses a common lattice type, face-centered cubic or cubic F, really symmetrical. The motif, just one single copper atom per lattice point. Simple.
But change that motif slightly.
And you get something totally different, right? Look at alpha brass. It uses a different lattice, primitive cubic, and the motif is now two atoms.
Yeah.
A copper atom at the corner, 000, and a zinc atom right in the middle of the unit cell at 12, 12, 12.
And diamond, I remember reading that uses the same lattice as copper.
It does. Also cubic F, like copper. But the motif is two carbon atoms, one at the origin, 000, and another slightly offset at 14, 14, 14 along the body diagonal. That tiny offset forces those incredibly strong tetrahedral bonds. That's diamond's secret.
Okay, so lattice is the pattern, motif is the stuff on the pattern. But how do we describe the repeating box itself? That's the unit cell.
Precisely. The unit cell is the basic building block, usually a parallel pipehead defined by three vectors A, B, C, and the angles between them. You stack these cells face to face, and they fill all of space, generating the whole lattice.
And these cells aren't all the same in terms of lattice points. You mentioned primitive earlier.
Right. A primitive cell, or P cell, effectively contains just one lattice point when you account for sharing at the corners. But many common structures use non-primitive cells because they reveal the symmetry more clearly. Like the cubic F for copper and diamond, that F-band means face-centered. It has points at the corners and in the center of each face. Turns out that contains four lattice points total per cell.
And there's I.
I is for body-centered, from the German Innenzentriert. Points at the corners, plus one single point right in the dead center of the cube. That gives you two lattice points per cell. Think of iron at room temperature.
Now, here's the part that really surprised me. You'd think you could make infinite combinations of these vectors and angles, but the number of unique lattices, it's limited.
It's incredibly limited. That's the amazing discovery by Breves back in the mid-1800s. He proved mathematically that there are only 14 unique ways to arrange points periodically in three dimensions, such that they fill space perfectly when stacked. Just 14 Breves lattices.
Only 14. For all the crystals in the universe, that feels tiny.
It is. It's a fundamental geometric constraint. These 14 lattices fall into seven crystal systems, like cubic, tetragonal, orthorhombic, monoclinic, and so on. Each system is defined by its minimum symmetry requirements.
Wow. And what about 2D, like graphene?
Even fewer. In two dimensions, there are only five possible lattices. Graphene, for instance, has that familiar hexagonal lattice, which is one of the five.
So these geometric rules are really strict. The source is touched on pushing this idea. Four-dimensional crystals, periodic in time and space.
Ah, yes, the idea of time crystals, or cylindrical crystals, where the atomic arrangement repeats not just if you move sideways, but also if you wake. It's theoretically proposed, but it's incredibly hard to wrap your head around how that structure would maintain itself. It really highlights how powerful and restrictive those 14 Breves lattices are in our familiar 3D world.
Okay, we have a structure. Now I need a way to talk about directions and surfaces within that structure. This is where Miller indices come in, the address system.
Exactly. We need precise notation. For directions, think of a line drawn from one point to another through the crystal we use square brackets, U, V, W. These numbers are basically the vector components along the unit cell axis, scaled to be the smallest integers.
Simple enough, like 100 would be along the x-axis.
Precisely. Now, for planes of atoms, like the flat surfaces you might cleave a crystal along or the ones x-rays reflect off, we use round brackets, HHKL.
Okay, the sources said this comes from reciprocal intercepts. That sounds complicated. Is there an easier way to think about HKL?
Yeah, let's simplify. Imagine the plane slicing through the unit cell. The Miller indices, HKL, tell you where it cuts the axis. Sort of. It's actually based on the reciprocals of the intercepts. So A, 1, 0, 0 cuts the x-axis at one unit distance, but it runs parallel to the y and z-axis, meaning its intercepts there are at infinity. The reciprocals give you 1, 10, 0. Using reciprocals keeps the notation as neat integers.
Ah, okay. So is a plane perpendicular to the 1, 0 direction, at least in cubic systems?
That's often the case in high symmetry systems like cubic, yes. And symmetry brings another shortcut. In a cube, moving along the positive x-axis 1, 0, 0 is physically the same kind of journey as moving on the positive y-axis 0, 1, 0 or the negative z-axis 0, 0, 0, 1.
Sure, they're equivalent directions.
Exactly. So instead of listing all equivalent directions separately, crystallographers group them using angle brackets. 100, 0. That symbol instantly refers to all directions like 100, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 100, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, and so on. Saves a lot of writing. The same applies to planes using curly braces, HKL.
Makes sense. Now, how do we know if a specific direction actually lies within a specific plane? Is there a quick check?
There is. It's a really useful tool called the Weiss zone law. It's fundamental for analyzing diffraction patterns and understanding crystal defects. The rule is simple. A direction UVW lies in the plane, HKL, if and only if the dot product of their indices is zero.
So plus VK plus WL plus zero. That's the check.
That's the check. If it equals zero, the direction is in the plane. We call a set of planes that all intersect along a common direction a zone, and that common direction is the zone axis. So, for example, the planes 111, 1 from 0, 0, 101 all contain the direction 111. So 11 is the zone axis for that set of planes.
Got it. Very practical. Okay, let's shift from coordinates to the underlying principles. Symmetry, rotations, mirrors, these operations that leave the crystal looking unchanged.
Yes, symmetry operations are key. They define the crystal systems, things like rotation axes, mirror planes, inversion centers, and also combinations like glide planes and screw axes, which involve translation. But let's focus on simple rotations first. An n-fold rotation axis means if you rotate the crystal by 360 divided by n degrees around that axis, it looks exactly the same.
Right, like a square has four-fold rotation.
Exactly. Now, because the crystal structure has to repeat infinitely in space, that translational symmetry we talked about, it turns out only certain rotation axes are possible in a lattice. You can only have one-fold, which is trivial, 360 degrees, two-fold, 180 degrees, three-fold, 120 degrees, four-fold, 90 degrees, and six-fold, 60 degrees of rotation axis. That's it.
Wait, only 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. What happened to five-fold rotation? Pentagon seems so natural. Why is five-fold forbidden in a repeating lattice?
Ah, the classic forbidden symmetry. It comes down to tiling. You simply cannot tile a 2D plane or fill 3D space using only objects with perfect five-fold symmetry without leaving gaps or having overlaps. Think about it geometrically. If you rotate a lattice point by 72 degrees, 36055, and then try to connect it back to the original lattice using the repeating lattice vectors, it just doesn't work. The distances don't match up with the required periodicity. It breaks the fundamental rule of the lattice.
So the need for perfect repeating translational symmetry rules out five-fold rotation. Wow.
Precisely. Now, it's important to note, as the sources mention, materials called quasicrystals were discovered that actually do show five-fold symmetry in their diffraction patterns. But the key is they achieve this by sacrificing perfect translational symmetry. They are ordered, but not periodic in the strict lattice sense.
Fascinating distinction. Okay, so if we combine all the allowed symmetry operations, rotations, mirrors, inversions that leave at least one point fixed in space, ignoring the overall translation, what do we get?
That gives you the point group symmetry. There are exactly 32 possible combinations of these symmetry operations, known as the 32 crystallographic point groups or crystal classes. They describe the symmetry of the motif and its environment.
And these point groups have real-world consequences, right? Not just abstract math.
Absolutely. Molecules or structures with the same point group symmetry often behave in similar ways. The sources mentioned water, H2O, and sulfur tetrachloride, SF4. They look quite different, but both happen to have the same point group symmetry, denoted 2 meter.
And what does that shared symmetry mean?
It means they have the same fundamental types of vibrational modes. So when you analyze their spectra at how they absorb infrared light, for instance, you'll see characteristic similarities because their underlying symmetry dictates how their atoms can wiggle and vibrate together.
That's cool. And I loved the chess piece example. You can tell the crystal class just by looking.
Yeah, that's a great illustration. If you imagine carving chess pieces from a single crystal cube, their shapes reveal the symmetry. A bishop, with its diagonal cut, often displays 3 mm symmetry, putting it in the trigonal system. A castle, with its squared-off top, typically shows 4 mm symmetry, which belongs to the tetragonal system. The macroscopic shape reflects the microscopic atomic arrangement symmetry.
Okay, let's bring this all together. We've got lattices, motifs, symmetry rules. Why is this deep understanding so critical for, say, an engineer designing a jet engine?
Because that anisotropy we started with, engineers don't just deal with it, they actively exploit it. The internal order is directly linked to macroscopic properties like strength, stiffness, and resistance to failure.
Like those turbine blades you mentioned, they're grown as single crystals.
Often, yes, especially for the most demanding high-temperature parts. Growing it as one continuous crystal eliminates grain boundaries. In a normal polycrystalline metal, those boundaries between the different crystal grains are weak spots. They're like easy highways for atoms to move along, especially under high stress and temperature, which leads to creep and failure.
So by making it one giant crystal,
you remove those highways. But more than that, you orient the entire blade along a specific crystallographic direction, say 001 in a cubic superalloy, which is known to have the best combination of stiffness and creep resistance at high temperature. You're using the crystal's inherent anisotropy to your advantage.
Amazing. But the most compelling example in the sources for me was about making steel stronger. How adding tiny carbon atoms to iron works differently depending on the iron's crystal structure.
Ah, yes. Austenite versus ferrite. This is a classic material science story, and it hinges entirely on crystal structure and symmetry. So at high temperatures, iron exists as austenite, which has that face-centered cubic F structure. Carbon atoms dissolve into the small gaps, the interstices, between the iron atoms. Specifically, they often sit in what's called an octahedral interstice.
Okay.
Now, in the highly symmetric FCC structure of austenite, this octahedral hole is perfectly symmetrical. It's quite regular. Its point group symmetry is M3MO. When a small carbon atom squeezes in there, it pushes the surrounding iron atoms outwards, creating strain. But because the site is so symmetric, the strain field it creates is isotropic, basically. The push is equal in all directions.
Like inflating a tiny balloon equally everywhere.
Good analogy. Mm. And this isotropic strain field doesn't interact very strongly with the strain fields of dislocations. Dislocations are line defects in the crystal, and their movement is what allows metals to deform plastically to bend. So carbon and austenite provide some strengthening, but it's relatively mild.
But then the iron cools.
Right. It transforms into ferrite, which has a body-centered cubic eye structure below about 912 degrees C. Now, the octahedral site in this structure is no longer regular. It's disordered. It's actually tetragonal with a lower symmetry point group, 4 mm.
So the hole the carbon sits in has changed shape and symmetry.
Exactly. And when the carbon atom sits in this irregular tetragonal site in ferrite, the strain field it creates is now strongly anisotropic. It pushes much harder in some directions than others.
And that makes the difference.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. This powerful anisotropic strain field interacts very strongly with the strain fields of dislocations. It effectively pins them, makes it much harder for them to move. This leads to significant strengthening and hardening. It's why adding just a tiny bit of carbon makes ferrite steel so much harder and stronger than pure iron or carbon dissolved in austenite. It all boils down to the symmetry of that tiny interstitial site.
Wow. So we've gone from abstract lattices and forbidding rotations all the way to understanding why steel is strong. It really shows how these fundamental rules of order govern everything about the materials we use.
It truly does. The sheer variety of materials we see in engineering stems from these surprisingly simple repeating geometric principles. But here's something important to keep in mind, a final thought. Throughout this discussion, we've mostly talked about perfect crystals, ideal lattices. The reality is most materials engineers work with alloys, ceramics with impurities, polymers. They aren't perfect. They are solid solutions. They have defects, missing atoms, extra atoms, regions of disorder. They lack that perfect infinite translational periodicity. Often, their bulk properties reflect an average of the local atomic environments, not the single perfect environment of an ideal crystal.
Right. So here's the final question to ponder then. Given that most real materials are imperfect, disordered, maybe even a bit messy at the atomic level, how much does that underlying blueprint, that potential for perfect order defined by the Bravais lattice and symmetry rules, still dictate the material's essential character and behavior? How does the ideal inform the real, even when the reality is flawed?